Welcome to our podcast for the week. This week I'm interviewing Will Edwards, and Will set up Archie Rose Distilling Co. In Rosebery in Sydney. Say hi, Will.
There you go.
Will, tell us a little bit about yourself.
So I came from a relatively sort of standard corporate background, I guess, at least professionally. I finished uni and then went down the management consulting route. Was in the city for a couple of years at Deloitte in consulting. And for me, the sort of spirit side of things and the distilling side of things was always just a hobby. I'd always been passionate about it and interested in it. And I used to do a lot of homebrew, and I used to mature whiskey and rum and white spirits at home in a few oak casks I had. But it was always just that. It was always just a hobby. And I used to read chemistry textbooks and things like that. Which in hindsight are pretty dull. But what happened really is it was always this nagging idea. And I always had this thought of opening a distillery, but at the time it was very difficult to see how it was actually feasible in Australia. There were very few commercial distilleries in the country. There were none in there's still really none in a proper urban centre.
I believe you were the first since 1853. Is that right?
Yeah, the first independent one in the city of Sydney. So that was pretty special. But it was one of those ones where, while it was something I wanted to do, it wasn't something that I actually knew whether it was feasible or not. So what happened really was, I got to the point where I realized I didn't want to be a consultant forever, and I needed a change, and took some time off, did a little bit of travel, and found myself in New York at just the time when the first distilleries since Prohibition were starting up, over in Brooklyn. So I went out there and spoke to the guys and saw the setup and heard about their story and where they came from. And that's for me when it really clicked, and I thought, there's so many similarities between New York and Sydney, and it sounds like a bit of a stretch, but there's a great bar scene. I mean, New York's probably a few years ahead of ours, but great bar scene, getting better and better. Great craft brewers, and this amazing history in distilling. I mean, New York obviously with Prohibition, and Australia and Sydney was pretty much built on rum. So that's when I came back from that trip and went, I want to know why no one else has done it. Because it wasn't like I just came back and naively wanted to jump in. It was more that I thought there must have been other people who've had this idea, but there's a reason there haven't been any distilleries pop up. And that's the reason that I wanted to figure out. And then once I found it, I was just going to put it to bed and I'd sort of be happy that at least I did the groundwork and figured out why it can't be done, and away you go. And that kicked off about six, seven months of research. And when I got to the point where I felt I'd been thorough enough and I still hadn't found any deal breakers, I mean, there were plenty of challenges that were almost deal breakers, but I hadn't found any deal breakers, that's when I thought, I'm going to commit, and left my last job, and that was over 2 years ago now.
Wow. And so you mentioned there were some challenges that were almost deal breakers. What were some of the challenges that you encountered when you were setting up?
The ones I came across in the research phase, I guess there's a few things with distillation specifically. So firstly, the equipment takes a long time to build. The stills, the copper pot stills, for example, they took a year. They're all built by hand by the only still maker in the country. But they're one of those things where you're basically committing to the order before you've got everything else lined up. Otherwise, you're going to find yourself down the track with, a premises and maybe some licenses and things like that and no equipment. So if you're going to try and make the timing work efficiently, you've got to do things concurrently. And so it becomes quite high risk because you're purchasing reasonably expensive equipment for a distillery that really doesn't exist yet. And there's also quirks in the licensing because you're operating on quite antiquated legislation where there's things like the final excise license, the final federal license to manufacture spirits. They won't assess that until the whole distillery is built and commissioned and ready to go. So you've got an entire distillery sitting there and no final license to actually operate it.
So you've got all your money invested, you've built everything, but you can't make booze yet until you get your license.
Exactly.
Big risk. Big
yeah,
risk.
And if you think about it objectively, it's maybe a bit of a stupid risk, but it is one that you can manage. And particularly with the ATO, I mean, and this is sort of getting a bit specific, but they're very easy to work with, and they're very happy to have a chat to you over the phone. And when we got to that stage where we were submitting our excise license, we'd probably been speaking with the ATO for over a year, and they were very familiar with the project. And so when we sent the application down to them, it was 35 days from submission to approval.
I guess from that example, you'd say that networking and relationship building are really, really important when you're building a business.
Yeah, I mean, with the ATO, you know, it's not your traditional networking, but it's more just about communication. I mean, don't feel like you... I guess there's a tendency to get a little bit intimidated by the big authorities and wanting to try and get all your ducks in a row before you even broach the idea with them. And on the one hand, yeah, sure, you want to be prepped. You don't just want to call them and go, oh, hey, I'm sort of thinking about a distillery, what do you reckon? But communicating with them early, I definitely recommend. I mean, one of the examples here, which, you know, it's not the most interesting example, but the ATO is very concerned with security. Because you are storing a lot of alcohol under bonds with the excise not yet paid, they want to make sure that the premises is secure. And so for me, during the construction phase, I was calling them and saying, look, these are the security measures we're planning to put in place. Are you happy with them? Are these sufficient? Da, da, da. And so from there, when we had the flexibility to change the construction of the building, we were speaking with the ATO. So when we got to the back end, they didn't say, oh, actually, we'd like this and that, where it was going to cost a hell of a lot more to rip things apart and redo them. So, communication, particularly with the authorities, you'll find that you know, they're not as scary as you imagine. They're sometimes a bit slow, but they're usually very, very happy to, you know, have a chat about your questions and help you out.
Cool. So you had this idea, you'd done your research, you decided that this is what you wanted to do. What was next? What was the next step?
Well, I mean, the first step, and I guess it depends on what industry you're in, but the first step for us was the longest lead time step, being the stills. So we knew they were going to take a year and there was no rushing them. So that was the first thing we committed to, and that sort of kicked off our timeline. And then if you're thinking about your Gantt charts, the top level line item for us was licensing. Because once the stills were underway and the clock was ticking, it was then a matter of going local council approvals, state liquor licenses, federal excise licenses. And again, a little bit like the equipment, while there were ways to make that process more efficient, there's no way to just speed it up. And so that then dictates your timeline. So I guess the key thing for us was working out which elements were the longest lead time, working on them first, if possible, and getting the clock ticking on them, and then everything else can get done in the meantime. But as long as you've got those long lead time things working away in the background, and they're the priority at least up front, you at least are on your way to getting to the end result, and you can then schedule everything else in the meantime.
A lot of entrepreneurs create unique products. And you mentioned earlier that you were the first micro distillery in Sydney for a long time. But guys, if you have a look at Will's website, you'll see that his gin's a little bit different to standard gin. So I guess, Will, what inspired you to make it different? And how did you come up with the unique flavor combination you've got now?
Making it different is an interesting question. I mean, firstly, I don't think, you know, there's anything interesting in just doing what was done before. Plus, you'll probably find that your customers won't really think there's anything interesting in doing what's been done before. It's a strange one. It gets sort of into the industry. So gin's a really fascinating spirit because there's not as much of a legal framework around what gin is. The defining characteristic is always juniper, but beyond that, you're quite free to do what you want with it. Unlike things like whiskey, where, you know, it's got to be matured in oak for 2 years or it's not whiskey. you know, it's got to have certain grains in the mash bill, malts in the mash bill to be classified as different types of whiskey. Gin's a bit more flexible. So what we set out to do was make a fairly traditional, fairly balanced, dry gin, but then try and substitute out a few of the really traditional ingredients for Australian natives, which was a bit more interesting. And for us, you know, that's where we landed on the lemon myrtle and the native blood limes, the river mint and the Dorigo pepper leaf, and some other fresh ones. But it was one of those ones where we didn't want to go down the road of a really crazy gin. You know, there's a few out there that are amazing examples of, you know, innovation, and they're very experimental, but they're not necessarily a gin that I would drink every day. I guess we wanted to make something that, while it was absolutely high quality and it was interesting, it was still what we consider to be a traditional example of a gin. Whereas there's a few gins out there that they might single out one botanical as the lead, and then everything else is a bit sort of is backup. Whereas we wanted to try and balance the botanicals and bring out, you know, each of their flavor profiles to create a coherent spirit. So going back to the original question, yeah, I mean, innovation is one of those ones where you can certainly push things as far as you want, but it's also something to weigh up and think about what you're actually trying to achieve as well. And for us, the innovation in the gin comes through in the way we distill, in that we distill every botanical individually, the way we design the equipment. The gin still's actually got 3 infusion points, which is very unique, if not completely unique. I've never heard of another gin still globally that has 3 infusion points. And that's one of the beauties of getting your gear made from scratch by hand.
What made you decide to do that?
Flexibility, and because I was interested to see what would happen. So most gin stills have an infusion point for your botanicals either in the pot itself, so in the spirit, where it actually, you know, macerates in the spirit, and that's where the oils from the botanicals get into the spirit, essentially, or often in the line arm. So as the spirit vapor comes up the neck and then goes around the corner over the swan neck and down the line arm towards the condenser, there's a basket there. So the difference between the 2 points is when it's in the spirit, it's actually in contact with the liquid. When it's in the line arm, it's the ethanol vapor that's passing through the botanicals. It's sort of a more gentle infusion. So we have both those points, and then another point in the base of the neck, which is another vapor infusion, but it's a hotter vapor infusion because the vapor has basically just come off the liquid out of the pot. There's very little condensation that's occurred already. And so we use those 3 points sometimes in isolation, sometimes combined for different botanicals, yeah, to draw out different flavor notes. So, yeah, a combination of flexibility and just because I wanted to.
Which is important.
Yeah.
You've got to do what you love, and you've got to do what interests you.
Yeah.
You've got to sometimes check if it works or if it doesn't work, and then
exactly. Learn
from that. If you started the whole journey over again, what would you do differently?
I think the number one thing, and this is pretty cliche because a lot of people say this, but obviously, you know, it holds true. The number one thing that I found challenging was time management. And, you know, it wasn't even that I was wasting time or not using time effectively. There was just so much to do. Even over the 2 years it took to set up, I was just flat out all the time. And I think if I could do it again, I probably would have got more help in earlier on. I think there's a lot of, not pressure, but there's sort of an expectation when you're starting up a business that, you know, it's got to be all on you from day one until launch and that sort of thing. And, you know, maybe if you're setting up a venture where your setup period is a matter of months rather than a matter of years, it might be more achievable to just knock it out. Whereas for me, I look back now and I think, you know, it would have been great to get some experience in, not necessarily, you know, as full-time employees, but maybe even just as contractors or consultants, you know, people who've been in the industry or had worked in related fields who could assist with not only the workload but also some of the technical aspects.
Mm-hmm.
That certainly would have been a help and probably would have taken a little bit of the strain off in the early days. During setup, that's probably the thing I would have done a little bit differently. Yeah.
And I guess that's something important to remember when you're setting up your own business, that you don't have to know everything.
No.
It's okay to ask people questions. I know your head brewer, he's kind of your magician with the flavors, and it just wasn't something that you knew. And guys, if you're setting up your own business, you need to think about what don't I know and who can I ask about that.
Yeah, and yeah, spot on. I mean, our head distiller is incredible. I mean, he's done nothing but make spirits his whole life, and obviously, in our industry, it's definitely something you need to consider because making spirits at home is illegal. So, unlike
did you make spirits at home?
I never distilled any spirits. I did a lot of home brew and infusions and maturation. But unlike brewing, it's not something that you can just practice at home and get to a point where you go, you know, actually, I'm nailing this. I think this is commercially viable. It's something that you literally can't test until you've got your licenses, and that's a big process. So, and then going back to your other point, you're spot on. You need to be really honest with yourself as to, firstly, what your strengths are and what your weaknesses are. Or not even weaknesses, but what are those things that someone else could do better than you could? And then the other one is, what should you be spending your time on? Because even there may be things that are a strength of yours, but as the, you know, as the founder of the business or whoever, the manager who's running the business, they just might not be the best use of your time.
Mm.
So you've got to be, you've got to be pretty upfront with yourself and go, should I be doing this? Or should someone else be doing this? And that's both from a skill set and a sort of time management standpoint. And in our example, having guys like Joe on as the head distiller, Dave Withers as our production manager, Nigel doing sales, Harriet as the venue manager and the bar. It's just an amazing team. I mean, I just certainly was not expecting to have such an incredible team at this early stage. And it means that I can then focus on the things that I do best, which are also some of the more dull businessy things, which the guys probably don't even want to do anyway. That's something that is not as easy as you expect, but something that you've got to really sit down and think long and hard about. Otherwise, you're either going to end up burnt out or you're going to end up underselling the business because you tried to sort of do things that maybe you should have got some help with.
When you set up your business, I guess you had in your mind an idea about how it was going to work and the things you had to do. What was different to that idea? So what kind of was the reality?
I'm sure everyone's going to say this, there's more administration than you expect. there's just more to running the business operationally day to day than you're expecting. I mean, and you can get caught in the trap of, oh, I'm too busy to work on this thing that down the line will save you a lot of time. And even recruiting staff is one of those things. I mean, advertising, interviewing, creating contracts, negotiating contracts, and signing someone up. And then once you've even done that, then training that person takes a lot of time.
Yeah, for sure. And money.
Yeah. And it's one of those ones where you know you have to do it because long term, you're just not going to be able to keep operating at this capacity without help. But it means that you've then got to dedicate hours and days and weeks to this where you already know you're behind on other stuff. So I think, and it's a dull one, but I think some of the things that shocked me were the amount of behind-the-scenes work that just is required to keep the business running. And then on the other sort of side of things, particularly in our industry, I was blown away by the support of the other distillers and distilleries. I mean, they are, at the end of the day, I guess, your competitors,
but
it's such a small industry in Australia that I would say 95% of people are more than happy to give you a hand. And that, I mean, it does go back to when I first started and I went down to Tasmania and spent a bit of time at Lark and Redlands and Nance, and also met Peter Bailey, our steelmaker, and Adam Burns, our cooper, and all of those guys. I mean, that was an important trip for me, and I went down a few times since then.
And research is key. I think that's a really good point, that you went down to Tasmania. I know you mentioned to me earlier that your steelmaker is the only steelmaker in Australia.
Yeah.
So research is so important to know what you're actually up against.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're right. You can never be too prepared, and unless you're amazing. you're never going to be as prepared as you should be anyway. I mean, there were things that, and this probably goes back to the question you asked before, there were things that I just had no idea about as I was going down the process. Things that you don't even know you don't know. So, you know, I did all the preparation and research that I could, and then all of a sudden you get blindsided by something out of left field, and you go, I had no idea that was even part of the process. So, yeah, that's going to happen. That's going to happen regardless of how well you prepare, and you've just got to make sure that you're...
you've got to learn to roll with the punches.
Exactly. Flexible, but also in a position to be able to deal with those things that come a bit out of nowhere. And hopefully your research and preparation, I mean, there's not too many, but there's always going to be a couple.
So, guys, if you do come down to Will's establishment, you'll see he doesn't just have a distillery, he also has a bar. So, Will, was the bar always part of the idea, or was that something that grew as your idea grew?
The bar was always part of the idea. The scale of the bar changed. So originally the plan was to have quite a small little tasting bar, maybe, I don't know, 50, 60 person capacity, and focusing on our spirits with then some interesting Australian spirits and beers and other things supporting it. But the nature of the warehouse that we're in meant that we ended up with about 180-odd square metres for a bar, which was way too big for a tasting bar. I mean, we could have put a tasting
bar
in there.
That's a big tasting.
Yeah, but it meant that there would have been a lot of rent going to a bar that probably wasn't generating the revenue to support itself.
Mm-hmm.
So we scaled the bar up a little bit, and we ended up with a bar that was a full-on sort of cocktail bar. Spirits focused still. Our spirits are, you know, in a lot of the cocktails, and they're our house pours, which is fantastic. But, you know, there's a back bar with 350-odd spirits there from around the world. And we've got four taps that we cycle through, just local craft beers at the moment. And then a beautiful wine list that we won an award for, actually. Which,
really?
Yeah, a couple of weeks ago. So it's a bit unusual for a spirits-focused cocktail bar to win an award for the wine list. But the sommelier who put it together, he's an old mate of mine from school. And he is incredible. He got back from Noma recently, and yeah, that's another story. The bar was always part of the plan, but it's scaled up significantly when we found the venue. And then, as we were talking about before, you've got to adjust. So that meant that I needed to get a proper venue manager in, and she's managing the place and is incredible, Harry Lee. And then we have five full-time bar staff as well. So it changes the dynamic, but for us, it's something that firstly is great in the early days of the distillery because it helps a lot with cash flow, but it also means that we can do, and I really hate this term, but like the proper grain to glass thing. We're literally going from the malt in the distillery creating spirits and then serving them in cocktails or neat or whatever you want in the bar.
Which is your unique selling point. Your customers can see where their spirits are being made and they can taste them in the same building. And that's a good way to be attracting people who have an interest in grain to glass.
Exactly. And it means for us that everything becomes a bit more approachable. Even if you're... You know, even if you're not a diehard spirits fan and you, at this stage you're not interested in going on a tour of the distillery or seeing how things are made, you just want to come down for a nice drink, it means that you've got that option. Whereas if we just had the distillery up and running, then we're probably closing ourselves off to a tighter, more, niche spirits-focused market. Yeah.
For the students listening, what advice would you give entrepreneurs? So what are some of the things that you learned, or what are some of the advice you wish you had when you started?
I think I think the key things sort of starting from the beginning are, again, being really honest with yourself as to the value of the concept. And it sounds a bit tough, but you've sort of got to think, well, are consumers going to care? Because there's so much out there. You know, there's so many, and every day, you know, there's so many great options in a bunch of industries, particularly in hospitality, you know, particularly in the bar scene. And you sort of think, well, why would people care about what we're doing? And that's a tricky one. And it often means that you have to sort of take a backward step to then take two forward and evolve your idea and change things, maybe scale down or up, depending on what you're doing, to make sure that you are genuinely different and that you are going to be of interest to people. Because if you're just going to be like the things that are already existing, it's not going to succeed.
And it's all a good and well to make your idea happen, but if it's not going to be realistic and people are not going to be interested in it, then it's a hobby, it's not a business.
Exactly. Another thing, I guess, is that you need to be honest with yourself as well as to why you're doing it. Now, it might not be something you share with everyone else, but there's a few examples I can think of where there's people who've just got into it because they want to make a buckload of cash. And that's fine. If that's what you want to do, and that's the goal, and you're upfront about it from day one, then that's not a problem. You know, it's not as romantic, I guess, but it's fine. And then, you'll structure the business differently, you'll focus on different things, and you'll do things a bit differently. I mean, I'm just thinking back to consulting case studies, and there's businesses that are actually unprofitable. Like, they're making a loss every year. But the way in which they're getting out there into the market meant that they were attractive for a big takeover, and they banked a check and went home happy. That's fine. If, on the other hand, you know, you want things to be really purist and niche and boutique, and, you know, it's not about the money, it's about the sort of dedication to your craft and that sort of thing, then you'd set up completely differently. And again, that's fine as well. And if you're somewhere in between, happy days. But I think, and I've come across it a couple of times where people have given me a call and wanted to catch up for a drink and talk about their ideas for, you know, a brewery or a distillery or something like that. And at the end of it, you're sort of thinking, well, you know, why do you really want to do this? And sometimes that's a question that they struggle to answer. And I think that before you embark on the whole setup process, you've really got to sit down and go, why do I really want to do this? Do I want to do this because I love this and I want to be doing this for the rest of my life? Do I want to do this because there's something out there that no one has made yet that I want to make? Or do I want to do this because I want to run a really successful business and make good cash and retire and that's it?
Buy a yacht.
Yeah. And you know, while I've got my own thoughts, none of them are necessarily right or wrong. It's more just about knowing where you're trying to get to before you start. And don't deceive yourself in any, you know, capacity, because in the end it's just going to come back and not ring true in what you end up creating. Yeah.
And so what advice do you wish you'd had before you start?
Well, the advice you always get is that, you know, it's going to be really hard, it's going to be a lot of work, you know, it's going to be difficult to manage your time and this and that. And
did you hear that a lot?
Oh, yeah, of course. And while you are listening to it, you probably naively and maybe a little bit arrogantly think, oh yeah, that's all well and good, but I'm sure it'll be fine. And it's not fine. It's really hard. So, or at least in my experience. So,
weren't you working 7 days and up until recently, 7 days a week?
Yeah. So the goal at the moment is still to try and take a day off a week, which I don't think I've managed that for about 9 weeks, but it's good to have a goal. But no. It's one of those ones where that you know, age-old advice on time management and how it's going to be hard work, you know, no one said it was going to be easy, is something that you need to really take on board. And you need to manage that from the start. You need to be disciplined. And, it, you know, obviously for me, I was working on this since the start of 2013, and it's only in the past couple of months that I've really understood that and gone, this isn't sustainable. You know, I need to change the way I'm working to be able to continue this long term.
For sure.
Because you can do it for a year or 2 years or 3 years, but you can't do it forever.
And not for your sanity.
No. So, you know, it's little things like I just block out now full days for desk work. You know, no meetings, no trips offsite, no anything. Just sit at my desk with the door closed. And you it sounds a bit, you know, it's like, well, come on, you got to be more flexible than that. But you really have to be disciplined. Otherwise, you'll end up just saying yes to everything. And all of a sudden, you know, it's midnight on Sunday night and you're finally getting into the work that has built up over the week.
And it's good practice. I do it. I block out time because, as you said, if you don't block out time, things manage to fill that time in and then you don't have the time to work with anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of those ones, and it's difficult as well, particularly in the start of setup where things are a little bit inconsistent. You will get periods where there's not a lot going on, and then you get periods where you absolutely run off your feet. And sometimes there's almost a little bit of guilt there where you think, you know, oh, I'm starting a new business, I should be working really hard day in, day out, you know, 18-hour days. And no, you shouldn't. You know, you should obviously be working hard to get things done as quickly as you can and to as good a you know, quality as you can. But if you can manage your time so that you're working less, it's not something that you should feel guilty about. That means that you're doing things effectively.
It's an achievement.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's something that I guess I'm only just starting to come to terms with. And now, you know, the less I can do, the better. And yeah, it's not easy to achieve that, but it's something that I wish I'd started working on or prioritizing a long time ago, because maybe once I got to the position that I'm in now, I'd be better at it. Yeah.
And having a little bit more time to yourself.
Yeah. Exactly. And look, you know, and again, it's another cliche one, but if you love what you're doing, it's not a problem. But you also just need to manage things, because otherwise things can get a bit out of hand.
For sure.
Yeah.
What's next for Will, and what's next for Archie Rose?
Next for me is more of the same, but probably some more of the exciting things. So we're just, and I suppose they tie in, because at this early stage, me and Archie Rose are sort of together a lot. So we're working on export.
Mm-hmm.
We've had a lot of inquiries from overseas, from Europe and Asia and the States and few other places, and while in our timeline it wasn't something that we were really going to look at until probably the latter half of 2016, because of the sheer volume of inquiries we've had, we've really pulled that forward. So one of the things we're working on is getting overseas, and closer to home, doing collaborations, keeping things interesting, you know, doing things differently, because
you've got a good spread at the moment. If you look at Archie Rose's Facebook page, you're always talking about new connections you're setting up and new places are serving your spirit. So it's kind of working quite well in Australia by the sounds of it. So
yeah.
You're overseas is your next step.
Yeah. And I think it's all tied in. I mean, if you can do things right at home, then the word's going to spread and those opportunities are going to pop up. But for us, locally, you know, we did a collaboration with Black Star Pastry where it was truffle season recently, and we distilled some black truffles and made a truffle distillate, which was really fascinating. And
was it nice?
It was nice if you love truffles.
Okay.
Joe, our head distiller, does not like truffles. And he thought it was the worst spirit he'd ever smelt in his life. I cannot understand why anyone would enjoy it. But it was fun. And then we distilled a beer with Batch Brewing Company in Marrickville. So they took a sort of dry hopped rye IPA, and then we double distilled that into a hopped rye spirit, which was really fascinating and something that they had wanted to do for a long time, and they're good friends of ours. So, and then a few other things in the works as well. So, you know, doing those little collaborations, whether or not they're for commercially viable products, is just interesting, both for us and I guess, you know, for customers as well, and something that keeps the business moving forward and you know, that degree of innovation in everything you do. And then, bigger picture export and obviously getting on the road a bit more. I mean, we did our first trip down to Melbourne 2 weeks ago and the reception was way beyond my expectations, which was great. And then I know we've got a lot of people in Perth who want us to go over there, and then up to Brisbane. And in fact, we did Canberra on the way down to Melbourne as well.
Oh, yeah.
And the Canberra bar scene is awesome. The Canberra bar scene, I probably haven't been in about 6 years. It's just completely changed.
Oh,
there,
wow.
There's some really cool stuff down there. So, yeah, a lot in the plan, but all exciting stuff, so that's good.
Cool. Well, guys, if you're interested in coming down to Will's premises, if you're in Sydney, it's in Rosebery. The bar has tours, so you can do a tour or a tour and a tasting. If not, or if you're not in Sydney, have a look on the website if you're interested. There's a lot about Will's story. If you want to try his spirits, there's also, you can buy the spirits there. This isn't a sales pitch, just if you're interested. It started to sound like that. Guys, if you've got any questions, shoot me an email. Otherwise, that's it for this podcast. Will, thank you so much for your time. Such an interesting story and journey and insight. Guys, I'll speak to you next week.
No worries. Thank you.
Thank you.